Virgin Radio.
Now, joining me in the studio, a very lovely lady who'd just been having a bit of a chat while the music was playing about her life and her background, and she's an author and a teacher, educating children on local history and Indigenous botanical medicine through her new book, which is called...
Call of the Boudier.
Call of the Boudier. That's a gorgeous name. Yeah. And hello, Molly. Molly Fernandez. Why have you called it that? There must be a story with the title.
Yes. So it's a book that's based in Margaret River, and Boudier means Indigenous leader. So it's connected to this story about the characters hearing the voice of and the guidance of this Indigenous leader.
Which is based on...
It's based on a tiger.
Yeah.
So this story is about this tiger that, and everyone loves tigers. So, you know, we used this program in my classroom with the tiger, and all the kids just absolutely love this tiger. So
I'm trying to connect it with Margaret River.
Well, it's funny because I had no connection with Margaret River in that sense. But I think 2 years after I wrote the book, I heard there is actually this legend of the thylacine in Margaret River. And I was like, oh, how interesting is that?
Try to think back if I ever heard that. I know there have been stories over the years of animals escaping from a circus.
Found some bones there of the thylacine. So I thought, oh, how funny is that? But this is actually not a thylacine. This is a Somalian tiger that has been rescued from the Ranthambore Tiger Sanctuary in India because of a bushfire.
Okay.
And they were planning this new high-tech tiger sanctuary in Boranup Forest on Wadandi Budja, just near Margaret River. And she is caught up in a road accident and then set loose in the forest.
Ah, there you go.
So she is in this ancient land trying to find her way with her companions, a numbat and a jitty jitty or willy wagtail. And,
gorgeous.
Of course, she meets Riley, a young boy from Margaret River Primary School, and she has to evade lots of dangers, including a bushfire, and... listen to the land and learn the language of the land.
I just get so amazed with people like yourself that sit down and write stories like this. I mean, you're inspired by, if you're teaching, obviously, what children love to hear about, and animals definitely are one of the biggest attractions, but you put them on a journey. And
yeah.
And so in the on the journey, what are they discovering? Because you obviously are educating about botanical medicine as well.
Yeah, so I've just always been one of these curiosity kids that loves to ask questions and find out what's behind things, and especially finding out about the local history and the local environment. And when I was planning my programs for Year 5, I just found a lot of the information I was coming across as Eastern States and Botany Bay and that kind of thing. So I was like, oh, Western Australia's getting a bit left out, and we just have such a treasure trove of stories and history that's just starting to get uncovered. And yeah, I just am this curiosity daydreamer. I think one of the kids that teachers actually don't enjoy, because they keep asking why. So yeah,
that's
so
what
I
kids
just
do
keep digging and finding out, and I love plants. And I came across a few that I just thought had to go in the story. And one was the Snotty Gobble Tree, which with a name like that, I thought, well, that's perfect.
What's a gobble tree?
A Snotty Gobble Tree is a poinsettia tree that is got little fruits that are sort of the size of a blueberry.
Right.
And they fall to the ground in June, July. And actually emus eat them a lot, they've discovered, and they were actually used to help with sore throats and colds and things like that.
It's called a snottle tree.
Snotty Gobble Tree.
Snotty Gobble Tree. I wonder who named that. That's
it's just the sort of perfect tree.
It is. For those ailments.
Yeah. And the other one I discovered is this bloodwood tree, which the sap was used by Indigenous people to treat wounds.
Right,
and
of course.
And it's an amazing material that I came across from doing an Indigenous medicinal workshop. And
now,
this
that's interesting. Tell us about the workshop.
Oh, it was absolutely fantastic. She went through all these plants that you can either eat or use medicinally. And bloodwood is incredible because the sap, she said everybody should have a little piece of this sap in their first aid kit, because you just grind it up add a drop of water, and then it's antiseptic, but it also forms a hard crest, so it can actually heal over your wound. Yeah, so there's all this information that's just
Well, why aren't we told more? Why haven't people sort of taken advantage of that? I mean, we can't go and find the tree, but if there were people that put these products together, it would help us.
Yeah, I think it's an exciting time because it's all just starting to emerge, and part of my research, I did a workshop with Josh Whiteland down in the Margaret River area called Kumul Dreaming, and there's just a lot of these wonderful workshops that are coming about now that we can take part in, and the information is starting to emerge.
Well, the knowledge is there, obviously, for us to learn, and we will, but it needs a company, I guess, to start to manufacture in the right way, with guidance and everything, not to mess it up, so that we can take advantage of that as well.
Yes, exactly. And just start understanding this land that we're living in and the stories that are just around us.
Yeah, that is interesting, especially at the moment. That's exactly, there's a lot of focus on everything like that. So where do you, what age do you teach? 5-year-olds, did you say?
Primary school kids.
Oh, that's fantastic. You've been doing that for a while, have you?
I have, yeah.
And so they know about the book?
Yes,
I've been doing some
workshops around the book and just unpacking the themes and the story, because it is a youth adventure novel with a historical component. So the characters do jump back into time and they come across the ghosts of the Bustle family sisters and the Wannerup massacre, which occurred down there. So I don't go into the massacre a lot, but it just mentions it, and it's something that I think is, it was actually described as one of the worst incidents in English history. So I feel like, you know, these things in our history are just, they just need to be provided to the public eye a little bit so that we can start having a dialogue about them.
Well, it's also that we learn from them.
Exactly.
The rest of the world isn't learning that war doesn't prove anything, does it? I mean, it's an awful situation. And this has just been released, has it?
Yes.
Oh, that is fabulous. They must be so proud of you at school. What age group is this sort of
Readers from 10 to adults. Actually, one of my main editors was my high school literature teacher, Leanne Pryor. So I felt extremely nervous handing over my manuscript to my old teacher.
I bet.
Just goes to show the impact teachers have.
You're so right. You always remember the good and the bad ones.
That's right.
Now, is this your first?
It is. I sort of started writing that, and then I just took a little bit of a side journey to do my picture book, which is Owen's Afternoon Tea, about an ornithologist, a young boy who's fascinated about birds. And it's a rhyming story. So it's kind of, the Owen's Afternoon Tea came out first, and then Call of the Boudiere has just been released.
Well, you've got another big project against other than teaching. I mean, this is a form of teaching as well, isn't it, really, when you think about it?
And
I think most people that, you know, read avidly are learning from it, whether it's fiction or fact or whatever. So this is, how beautiful. Who did the drawings?
The illustration is done by Marlene Lozano, so we got together and did this project and brought this story to life, and it's really just my way of celebrating science and getting kids to be a little bit more aware of raptors, because raptors are just so fascinating.
They're the
birds of prey, eagles, and this book centres on Owen's adventure as he's trying to go and find the harpy eagle in its natural habitat. But the workshops that I've been doing at schools, I talk about the barn owl and the wedge-tailed eagle, which just have this incredible power, and they're doing a huge contribution to our environment. So I discovered that barn owls actually remove about, I think it's 2,000 mice from the environment every year.
Oh my gosh,
which equates to about 2 million when you think about the breeding.
Yes, of course.
So they're just incredible birds that are really important to our environment.
I want to hear more about that, because I just think there's nothing stronger than nature. you know, I've never really thought about it a lot through life. As you're growing up, you just get on with it and you don't look up very often, but you start to.
Yeah, and I don't think you understand as much how the pieces fit together like a puzzle, don't they?
Very
and,
true.
You know, one thing comes out and everything falls apart. And,
yeah.
And here in Western Australia, we have such a unique environment with more wildflowers than any other in the world. And that's just a kind of a hint as to how precious our environment is here and yeah. how interesting it is.
Very true. We can't be damaging it, that's for sure. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Gretchen Radio. We're on a bit of a bush tour with you today, aren't we, Molly? Molly Fernandez, author and a teacher, and taking nature very seriously, which we all should. I was just saying to Molly, when you're growing up, there was a man called Harry Butler. He was a naturalist in Perth. And I remember from school, he used to take tours out into the countryside, into bush, not countryside, in the bush, and make us be aware of what's there. And that's exactly what we need today, don't we?
Absolutely. And there's so many programs at the moment doing things like that, that are taking kids on walks and tours and doing workshops with natural history and plants and just sharing the importance of different areas, the importance and how they were used in Indigenous culture and how the plants can yeah. help with medicinal purposes.
Well, you know, growing up, when we were growing up, yes, in school we learned an awful lot about English history, American history to a point, but not an awful lot about Australian history. And now we have to sort of start to educate kids to appreciate what we've got here. We're such a lucky place to live, aren't we?
We are. We have so much opportunity, and just this interaction with the environment is so easy for us, you know, like
yeah.
we can live outdoors and explore the outdoors.
I think what it does once you have a bit of an understanding of life and nature and everything like that, I think it's amazing. I think nature's a religion, quite frankly. We just take it all for granted. But children then have an appreciation for it, respect for life.
As soon as you start talking to them about birds or plants, they're just absolutely fascinated.
I have a naturalist join me on the program quite often, actually. There's nothing he doesn't know about birds. He's absolutely fabulous. He does bird calls and all sorts of things for me. But I've sort of realised I don't look up enough. I do now. When you start looking up into the trees and see the birds and the different calls they make and what are they thinking, where are they going, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the kind of patterns, you know, so in my garden I have singing honey eaters and the jitty jitty, which I just think is the most fabulous name for the bird. That's the indigenous name of the willy wagtail.
Oh.
And it's called that because of how it sounds.
Jiggy, jiggy, jiggy.
Yeah, exactly. It's fantastic. And we also have these black-faced cuckoo shrikes, which are hardly ever seen in the garden. So I only see one or two here and there. And I just really enjoy seeing these little changes and patterns and who comes to the bird
bath. They know who you are.
Bath. They do. They really, really
do. The word's
do.
Out.
Yeah,
you'll have a
exactly.
whole flock of them coming in soon.
That's
and
right.
And I think perhaps, you know, once we start to design our gardens, our landscaping, you attract certain things, don't you?
Absolutely, mm. yeah. And the birds that really caught my attention when I first wrote Owen's Afternoon Tea were actually not Australian birds, but these golden warblers that predicted the shift at the level of tornadoes in the season. So scientists are actually using these birds to help them understand the patterns of tornado seasons in America and South America.
How do they do that?
So these birds, actually there was a documentary about it, they predicted that it was going to be really bad tornado season, so they shifted their migration to the south.
Oh, is that how you find out
it all
where they go?
Along to avoid this. And it's just fascinating to me because I think this was way before the tornado started, so they must have just detected like a barometer, the pressure in the air or something.
Wow.
And it just really changed the way I think about birds.
Oh,
I just thought,
the intelligence.
Well, they're really actually working hard in the environment.
What about the birds that migrate tens of thousands of miles from one side of the board to the other?
I know, amazing.
Yes.
And butterflies as well.
Do
the workshop I've
Gee,
been
be
doing is
flapping
birds
hard,
and butterflies.
Wouldn't they?
I know the monarch butterfly can fly 4,000 kilometres. So
oh
that's potentially from one side of Australia to the other.
Mm.
And yeah, it's
I think they're
really
smarter than us. I think they're all smarter than us, quite frankly.
Definitely.
Now, you call yourself part nomad and part immigrant and part WA.
Definitely.
You grew up in Perth.
Yes.
But you went across in a couple of years, you're in war-torn Beirut.
That's
my
correct.
Goodness,
yes.
A bit scary for a child. It sort of reflects at the moment what's going on, and we won't go into that because everyone's terribly upset about it, but it must bring you memories, I suppose, as a very young child.
Yeah, I was actually a baby, so I was there just until I was two, but it is something that's always been a part of me, and you always think that you do pick up kind of a history from that time, and I think it just makes you really appreciative of the journey that you've made with your family and the connections that you have with people. And I think it's those connections that you have with people that you just really start to appreciate.
Oh, we all should be at the moment, that's for certain. While we're here, we feel helpless, I suppose, in this situation, just knowing it's going on. So you gained a deep respect and appreciation for the power of the written word, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to educate everyone.
Yeah.
And you spent time in the Kimberley.
I did.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's interesting up there. They're just discovering some incredible skeletons of prehistoric koala bears or something up there.
Oh,
it's phenomenal.
I didn't know about that.
Yes, yes.
Really? On the east, on the west coast here?
Up in the Kimberley somewhere. Yeah. They were larger. Huge koala bears.
Yes, wow. See, we have got so much mapping to do because the number, which features in my book too, used to be all the way across the bottom of Australia, and it's now only in Margaret River and Mount Barker.
Oh, I have to protect
and
that.
And this is the thing, these information that comes out, it's just all these little mapping that needs to be done, doesn't
it? It does. Well, you're doing it, so
we
just keep at it, okay? But to get your interest in reading, I think as a child, I think most of us read an Enid Blyton book.
Definitely, yes. Loved our Enid Blyton.
She did Something Seven and Famous Five, I think,
didn't
she?
Yes, Secret Seven.
Secret Seven,
and
that was it.
Famous Five, and of course there was the Magic Faraway Tree.
How amazing.
Yeah.
Because as an adult, you have to know what children want to read and get emotional about.
Mm.
And she was fantastic at that.
Yes.
Who else did you admire?
Well, I really liked Ernest Hemingway, and as I got older, I read Dylan Thomas, and he's very poetic in his style, and he actually, his book, Under Milkwood, was first a radio play, actually, so his writing is all very much about the rhythm of poetry and description, and I think that's how my writing has evolved as well. I just am very much interested in that heavy description and transporting the reader to this other environment.
It's interesting, isn't it, as a writer, you have to describe something that you're seeing or thinking about or imagining for us to understand. Because we're not in your mind, it's our mind. We have to interpret, so you have to think about how to do that.
Yes, and writing the book, my first book, I actually learnt so much about the fact that writing a book is much more than just having a creative idea.
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes into expressing that, but then also trying to communicate it and then work out all these little problems that come up with where you've taken your reader and how do you attach things and solve things and... It's quite an unexpected endeavour. I thought, just sit down and write my idea. But it was much more complicated than that.
Well, they've got to keep the reader's attention to start with, don't you? So
definitely.
do you actually, because you have fantasy with it all, but you do have fact in there too, do you have a series of plots sort of thing? So you get people's interest at first, we take them on a journey and something goes wrong and that gets fixed. Do you do anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, while I was writing this, I had this idea of this tiger in the Boronup forest just trying to discover this different ecosystem, and that's where it started. And then as the story evolved, I moved it into the town and talked about the Margaret River Primary School and had all, and took lots of ideas from working in the classroom and observing teachers and
the children.
And it ended up to be this enormous sticky sort of thing. I used sticky notes and much like how I used to write university papers, actually. I'm definitely a spreader.
Yeah, but you know where everything is.
That's right.
Your organised mess. Yeah, absolutely. How long did it take you to write this one?
3 years.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. It's not overnight, that one, is it?
No, definitely not. So yeah, lots of trips to Margaret River, which is kind of a pleasure.
Well,
it
could be worse. It could be worse.
Yeah.
So how did you get the publisher interested?
I think when you write a book, you just get it as ready as you can, and then you go through the process of editing, and then you just send it out to as many publishers as you can. So it's really just about approaching as many publishers as you can and trying not to get disheartened. I remember after about the 10th rejection, thinking about Elizabeth Jolly or Steven Spielberg, and I can't remember which one, but one of them wallpapered a wall with their rejections. I was like, okay, I'm going to set a number and I'll just keep trying and keep trying.
Whoever makes the decision whether they're going to accept or reject you, they've got to be able to understand what you're saying, don't they?
Absolutely,
they have to think similarly to yourself, and that's the difficult part.
Definitely.
And they have to look ahead of commercialisation of things and selling and so on.
Yes.
So is that online, or are people going to pick it up at a bookstore?
It's available in 4 bookshops in Perth, so West Books, Dimmicks and Subiaco, and Planet Books in Northbridge and Mount Lawley.
Okay, good on you.
You can also order it online, and the schools and libraries can order through West Books,
Well, if this is aimed, it is aimed, is it, like you said, at a particular age group, so it would probably be not the children that come in and buy it, it would be the mums or the grandparents that might purchase it.
Yeah, I mean, I just did a workshop at Joondalup Primary School with some year 4/5s, and I gave away a prize for the best writing, and it's always a fantastic thing to see kids bringing their skills out and their writing skills and drawing skills. And the kids were just enraptured, and I think it's because it is this unique story of this tiger, and kids just get captivated by this tiger, you know.
Well, the thought of it, if it actually happened, that one did escape down there, would be quite fascinating. Mm. But like you say, it was based on a story that was around for years, that one did end up in the forest down there.
Yeah, and I think I just thought there's so much land down there and we're so protected and safe here. What a great idea to have a tiger sanctuary.
Okay, what next? You're going to let the elephants on the loose or something, eh?
Well, I'm actually going back to Western Australian stories. So I'm writing about my great-grandmother's wedding dress, which is in my house.
Oh, really?
She made it.
She still got
it. In 1913, and she came from Arbroath in Scotland and caught the boat down to Albany, and then took the 2-day trip to get to Pingrup, where her husband had seen all the lakes and decided it was going to be just like Scotland.
Oh, yes.
So it's really about her journey to Pingrup and this incredible stoicism and courage that these people had to face a very difficult beginning.
That's the way it was then.
Yeah.
How do you know all about your grandmother? None of us do, really.
Well, my grandmother wrote a little bit of a history on these 2 little typed pages, and my great aunt wrote a history, so I've got 2 from there. And we just had the Pingrup centenary, actually, so we went down, took the dress to be part of the display last weekend, and it's great because that community is getting all the stories together and culminating it, because we're at a really fragile moment, I think, in history now, where people are getting older and the stories need to be captured.
I don't think, I've often said this, we should be leaving our stories behind, because, you know, we wonder about our grandparents, you know, a little bit, but most of us don't as much as you have.
Yes, and going online, you think, oh, it's great, there's so much online, but it is actually very difficult to find what you are looking for online amongst everything that's there.
It's not the personal story that you get, you know, you may get the facts, but you don't know what they were thinking at that time, how they managed at that time, their day-to-day activities, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. So just very quickly before you finish, what's her gown like?
Well, it's very elegant 1900s type style, but it does have these little features. It's got these little flat bows down the side, which to me have a kind of an Asian quality.
Okay.
And her husband and her they spent some time in India, actually. And so, again, it's this whole story that you think, oh, I wonder where this, how this design came about, you know?
How is it that you've had this for so long? Passed down?
It was actually in a trunk, and if any of your listeners have got an old garment in a trunk, I say take it out right now, because it's the worst thing for it, because they say if it's crumpled up, the weight's on it. So we actually got a Patricia Moncrief came and restored it. So she's this amazing restorer who's worked for museums and everything. She
That's
restored
a treasure.
The dress, and it's now on an acid-free mannequin.
I can't do anything but to congratulate you, Molly. It's just it's fascinating. Let us know when you finish in another 3 years if we're still around.
Okay. I think it's going to be quicker this time.
Lovely to see you. Thank you for joining us.